It's the week of May 4th. I'm Cindy Wolf Boynton, and on this episode of the Literary New England Radio Show, I talk with Aline Ohanessian on her novel Orhan's Inheritance, a book that shifts between the last years of the Ottoman Empire and 1990s Los Angeles. It tells the story of a young Turkish man who leaves his family's village to travel to the U.S. and discover why his recently deceased grandfather bequeathed the family home to a woman his family has never heard of, a woman who lives in a facility for elderly Armenians. It's a novel that brings a neglected time in Turkish history to life, but the education the novel provides is secondary to Aline.
A good novel can change the way you think about love or memory. If I could do that and also tell people about something they didn't know about in history, then that's wonderful. But it wasn't my number one goal. I didn't set out to educate the world about this particular historical event.
I'll give away copies of Orhan's Inheritance and all the books featured on tonight's show, including Patricia Park's Re-Jane, a Korean-American retelling of Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre that's set between Manhattan and Seoul.
I think part of the challenge of a retelling is that you're taking something that is beloved in the hearts and minds of the public and then putting your own spin on it. So if you hew too closely, you come off as a cheap imitation. If you depart too much, then readers would lose any echoes to the original and you know, you may lose them on that journey. So it's a really fine line.
I also talk with Kirsten Valdez-Quaid about her short story collection, Night at the Fiestas. Kirsten is in New England this week, doing an event on Wednesday, May 6th in South Hadley, Massachusetts, and on Saturday, May 9th in East Sandwich, Massachusetts. You'll hear details about her appearances in our interview, where her passion for fiction clearly comes through.
Mainly my writing is fiction, and I often find when I am working on an essay that I'll just start fictionalizing, and then I have to stop myself and find the place where the lies and storytelling started creeping in. Remind myself that this is nonfiction. So it really is, fiction becomes a habit. It's a fun habit.
The 10 stories in Night at the Fiestas are set in New Mexico. Each features a troubled character who in some way needs to escape the past. They include a deadbeat father of a pregnant teen who tries to transform his life by playing the role of Jesus, a young man who discovers his estranged father and a boa constrictor squatting in his grandmother's empty house, and a lonely retiree who becomes obsessed with her housekeeper.
So Night at the Fiestas was written actually over a decade. The earliest story, which is the first story, Nemesia, I started in, I think, 2005. So I've been working on these stories for quite a long time. And they're set largely in northern New Mexico, where my mother's family is from. They've been there since the Spanish conquest, so for about 300 years. And I've always felt very connected to my mother's family and also to this sense of this long and conflicted past in this particular landscape. I moved around a lot as a child. We left Albuquerque when I was little, but always returned to New Mexico, where my grandparents and all my extended family live. And so that really, through all the moves, that really was home to me.
So is it place that brings these stories together, or are they all meant to stand alone?
They're certainly all meant to stand alone, and they were written to stand alone. But, you know, there are several themes that I came to understand that I kept returning to. And really, it's been since seeing them collected and all brought together that it became clear to me just how frequently I returned to themes of family and betrayal and also home and connection to the landscape.
So have you always been a short story writer, Kirsten?
I have been. I love short stories. I read short stories a lot. I first really started reading short stories in high school, and that was mainly what I wrote. Short stories are wonderful because you can dip into a world and embody a character for, you know, several months or, you know, in some cases years, but for as long as it takes to get through the story, and then you get to embody a new character in the next story. And so for somebody who's really curious about people, as I am, it's a fun way to get to take on the persona of a lot of different people.
So have you done any other writing aside from fiction?
A little bit of nonfiction here and there, but mainly my writing is fiction. And I often find when I am working on an essay that I'll just start fictionalizing, and then I have to stop myself and backtrack and find the place where the lies and storytelling started creeping in, and you know, delete, and then remind myself that this is nonfiction. So it really is. Fiction becomes a habit. It's a fun habit.
So I'm interested in what you said before, that you were interested in people. As someone who was interested in people, you could have become a nurse. Mm-hmm. You could have become a social worker. You could have become an elementary school teacher. You could have become a lot of different things. But why put your interest in people onto the page?
That's such a good question. I've always been a reader, and I've always sort of told myself stories, you know, just in my daily life. I, you know, if I encounter somebody striking in a grocery store, I'll start imagining what their lives would be like. There was a time in college when I thought I might want to be a psychologist or a therapist. My mother is a marriage and family therapist, and so I took some psychology classes, but it became very clear that what really interested me about that profession was the chance to sit in a room and have people tell me their stories and their secrets. And I understood that that was probably not the best motivation to go into that field.
What is it about the written word, though, that just kind of gets to you?
You know, I think it's that the books I read, you know, both as a child and a young adult, it moved me. The books, you know, books really did change my life. It sounds so corny, but, you know, the chance to sink into another world and another person's perspective is, to me, so liberating and thrilling, that... And you know, just you asked about the written word, but just the music of language I find deeply moving and exciting when I read a sentence that a writer I admire has written. You know, I'll often read it over and over and over again. It just is thrilling to me.
Well, clearly your work is also thrilling other people. You are the recipient of a 5 Under 35 award from the National Book Foundation. Your work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Southern Review, The Best American Short Stories, among other places. You've received fellowships from Yaddo and the McDowell Colony in New Hampshire. So you know how to spin a phrase, for sure.
Well, thank you. I mean, and I do think it's the most exciting thing for a writer to discover that what she's written does resonate for somebody else. You know, so much of writing takes place in a solitary room, you know, it's just me in front of my computer. And so often as I'm writing, I have to push away any idea of an audience, and tell myself that really what I'm doing is just trying to understand this character in this moment, in this paragraph. So it is really exciting when readers respond to that. It's the biggest dream for a writer.
And this is going to be a totally random question, but as I look at your biography on your website, I see that the photo credit for your photograph there is Maggie Shipstead, who I'm assuming is a New England author of Seating Arrangements and other novels, Maggie Shipstead.
That Maggie Shipstead spent quite a bit of time in New England, and certainly her first book is set on a fictionalized version of Nantucket, but she's actually from Southern California.
I was going to say she went to Stanford.
She was a Stegner Fellow, and that's where we met.
You were a Stanford Fellow. Oh, how fun!
Yes, and she's a marvelous writer and also great with a camera. She was willing to take many, many pictures of me one day.
Oh, my goodness. So that photograph is taken in California.
It is. Yes, we were about to go on a hike, and we had just driven 2 hours to Point Reyes, and then she said, let me just take a couple pictures here. She's a very dear friend.
I love that connection. That's fabulous. We've had her on the show a couple of times. She's just marvelous.
She is.
So what would you like readers to see inside Night at the Fiestas? Is there something that you hope that they're going to learn or experience from these stories?
Yes, I don't think there's anything in particular that I want the readers to learn. I don't really approach my stories from that angle, but I think what I most want is for readers first to be interested and entertained and immersed in the world of each story, but also to understand my characters, to feel that they understand why my characters make the choices they make, even if they're not particularly admirable choices.
And is there any particular story where we really see you, Kirsten?
I think I come through in all of the stories to some extent. I mean, all of these characters, whether it's a, 70-year-old retiree or a 33-year-old, drunk deadbeat dad, these characters are all me. On some level. I really kind of identify with Jeff from The Guest House. It's a story about a young man who has gone home to take care of his grandmother's affairs. She's just passed away. And he's a first child and sort of beleaguered and filled with an outside sense of his own responsibility, and comes to understand that maybe this role that he's given himself in the family isn't quite as necessary as he's always believed it is. And I'm a first child, and I sort of understand that impulse and feeling that he has. So I think I identify with him quite a bit.
And you've had some terrific dates where you've had speaking events and signings. And on May 6th, you are going to be in Massachusetts at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley as part of some other East Coast dates. How do you like reaching out and spending time with your readers?
It is so fun. I was surprised by how much I love these events. I love being able to talk to my readers, talk to people who aren't yet my readers and I hope will be my readers. It's like I said, writing is so solitary, and it's just an absolute joy to meet people and to hear what they like to read and to hear their stories. I've been having such a wonderful time doing all of this, and I've spent some time in Massachusetts, and I'm really looking forward to that reading. I have another reading at Titcomb's Bookshop on May 9th at 1 p.m. in East Sandwich, Massachusetts.
Oh, wonderful. So you're going to get to go to two really great New England bookshops.
I'm so excited for it.
Oh, that's wonderful. And actually, before we started recording, you had mentioned that you were going to be going back to the McDowell Colony this summer. Can you tell us what you're working on, or is it a secret?
I'm working on a novel. It's still, you know, finding its story and its shape. So, but it's about a family in northern New Mexico, and there's some, you know, betrayal and complication and exciting things like that. You know, I got so much work done at McDowell. It's such a special place. And so I'm just really delighted to be going back there. I got some of my best work done that I've ever gotten done. They put you in a lovely little cottage, and a little fawn came by my window almost every day. It was really heaven.
Now, theoretically, you could go to a conference like that and decide that you're going to sleep away the day or go hiking most of the day. You have the passion and the drive and the self-discipline really just to write all day.
Not quite all day. I mean, I read a little bit. I do go for walks. I find that to be really inspiring, and that, you know, when I'm walking and, you know, looking at trees and wild turkeys, there's something about that that can loosen ideas, even if I'm not thinking consciously about the problems that I'm tackling in my novel. Sometimes it's, you know, just being outside will loosen the log jam.
Yes.
But, you know, I teach at University of Michigan, and I really do depend on the breaks between semesters to get a lot of work done. So it feels urgent, and I'm so excited to have this block of time. And so I am looking forward to just diving in and working as much as possible.
I love what you say about it being urgent. It feels so urgent. The story is just waiting to come out of you, but you need that time and that place.
I do. You know, there are writers, and I hope to train myself to become more of a writer like this, who can, you know, if they have half an hour here or there, can sit down and work. And I can do some of that especially at the revision stage. But when I'm drafting a story or now a novel, it really does take me time to immerse myself in the world and to really feel and smell and, you know, touch all of the things I've built into this fictional world. So, you know, having big blocks of time, you know, away from email, away from work, away from, I have a parrot who can be a distraction. that time I just find so, so essential and really liberating.
Well, that's fabulous. Well, we will be really excited to see what you come up with. We need to wrap things up, Kirsten, but any final thoughts? Night at the Fiesta? Why should someone pick it up?
I think people should pick it up because I write about good people who are flawed and who are really trying. And I really hope people will be entertained.
And God, which one of us isn't flawed and not really trying?
I mean, I certainly am flawed and trying.
Me too. Every day. Kirsten, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure.
Win a copy of Night at the Fiestas by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Do the same thing to win a copy of Read Jane, the debut novel by Patricia Park of New York that hits bookstores Tuesday, May 5th. Patricia was in Boston this past weekend to speak at Grub Street's annual Muse and the Marketplace conference. A graduate of Boston University's MFA in Fiction program, Park will be back in Massachusetts next Monday, May 11th, for an event with Margot Livesey at Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge. In Read Jane, Patricia's protagonist, Jane, is an orphan trying to escape from Flushing, New York. She works there in her strict uncle's grocery store before she becomes an au pair, begins an affair with the father of the children she cares for, and then flees to Seoul. In Seoul, Jane discovers both her lost family and who she really is. The novel has gotten terrific pre-reviews, so my first question to Patricia was how she was feeling knowing that she was going to wake up on Tuesday, May 5th, and her novel was going to be out there for everyone in the world.
I'm excited but nervous. You spend this time working on a project, you kind of put your life's work out there on the line, and then to have it face the public reception, you have no idea how the public will receive it. So I'm hoping for the best, but expecting the worst.
But you've gotten great advance reviews, so that must make it pretty exciting.
Oh, thank you. I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, Kirk is, as we all know, can be notoriously snarky, so I was definitely feeling the love and really happy and grateful for that, and the Publishers Weekly as well. So I'm going to keep my fingers crossed that this bodes well for through the launch of the book.
So what is ReJane all about?
ReJane is a coming-of-age story about a half-Korean, half-white orphan girl who grows up in Flushing, Queens, and she travels from Queens to Brooklyn to Seoul and back in an effort to find herself. And on top of that, it's a Jane Eyre retelling to boot.
So are you a big British fiction fan?
I am. I think the Victorian English canon very much shaped my literary consciousness. And it's funny because I'm a Korean girl from Queens. What right do I have what do I have in common with a white orphan girl from Victorian England? But for whatever reason, Jane Eyre in particular was a novel that stayed with me. And I think that's part of the power of great literature, that it can speak across cultural divides and touch you on a personal level.
So you mentioned that you grew up in New York City. Is this book, and you're also Korean, is this book about you?
There are a lot of overlaps in my upbringing as well as my protagonist, Jane Rees. We're both born into, Jane wasn't born into this, but grew up in a Korean community in Queens. We both kind of spent our childhood and much of our young life riding the 7 train, leaving Flushing Main Street into Manhattan and just staring out at across the swamps and the wasteland of Queens into the Manhattan skyline. And I think that's just such a powerful image that Jane and I both share, that we spent our whole lives growing up in a place that we were just dying to get out of.
So when did you realize that you had a story that was novel worthy, or that you thought could be turned into a novel?
So when I was a little kid, I would misbehave, my mother would always tell me, in her broken English, you act like orphan. And I never understood that. How do you act like an orphan? You either are one or you aren't. And then when I first read Jane Eyre, when I was 11 or 12, I was struck because the very same epithets that were thrown at her, that she was wicked and mischievous, were kind of the similar, the construct I came to learn later than in grad school, that the construct of the Victorian orphan had a lot of parallels with that of the Korean orphan, the Korean post-war orphan. And what my mother had meant by that, I later learned, was that to act like an orphan meant to behave in a way that shamed your family, and essentially that you had no good family education. So I guess my mind kind of drew that link between across nations, across time periods, to form this construct of the orphan. So although a lot of the background material between Jane's life and my own are similar, our life stories actually are not, because she is a mixed race figure and she has been orphaned.
So I'm really interested in this whole idea of retelling a classic story. And actually this whole phenomena has kind of caught my attention lately, but you're the first author who's done it that I've spoken with it since I've developed this fascination. So sorry.
Oh, you no, are now what an honor.
You are now my guinea pig as I explore this. But so when you are retelling a classic story, and certainly you can only speak, I guess, from your own experience, but I mean, do you look at Jane Eyre and then plot out the plot points and then say, okay, how can I use these different plot points in a different century with a different character?
No, you're definitely right that retellings seem to be in the zeitgeist. I mean, we have Sherlock, 21, now 22 Jump Street, Transformers, and so on. For me, I try to stay true to what my first impression and what first drew me to the book, to Jane Eyre. And when I first read it as a preteen, I was struck by a character who self-describes as poor, obscure, plain, and little. She was such a departure from the beautiful Disney heroines that I was weaned on. And for me, throughout this whole process and going back and forth and studying the structure and the plot of Jane Eyre, the original, and trying to weave my own novelistic story or take on it, that was the one kernel that I tried to stay true to, that a character who was not conventionally beautiful, who in by all rights should have not had any airtime, that she yet had such an unwavering sense of self and independence. And my Jane also tries to stay true to the spirit of that.
Huh. I love that. So Jane doesn't go through all of the exact adventures that Jane did.
Not all. I mean, I think part of the challenge of a retelling is that you're taking something that is beloved in the hearts and minds of the public and then putting your own spin on it. So if you hew too closely, then you come off as a cheap imitation. If you depart too much, then readers would lose any echoes to the original and you know, you may lose them on that journey. So it's a really fine line. Jane does have, my Jane, that is, has different challenges that she goes through. She picks up, and there is a bit of a peripatetic narrative in that she's going from one place to the next and kind of returns back to certain places. So I try to stay true to those pinpoints, but certain things don't translate into our times. You know, first off, a marriage proposal from a cousin, you know, that's not so much keeping with our time. So I was tasked with trying to find a fresh way of retelling, but also making a heroine that translates to the 21st century.
Neat, neat. And this book is taking you on a lovely tour. This past weekend, you were in Boston at Grub Street's Wonderful Muse and the Marketplace Conference. And actually, you're going to be in Boston, in Cambridge, again next week on Monday, May 11th, to do an event at the Harvard Bookstore. And you're going to be talking with Margot Lindsay. How wonderful.
It is such an honor to be speaking with Margot. You know, as you and your listeners may know, Margot herself has penned her own Jane Eyre retelling,
mm-hmm.
The Flight of Gemma Harvey. And I think it will be a really interesting dialogue to see how we both took the same original source text and departed from it. So I'm really looking forward to that event, and I'm looking forward to meeting with other Boston readers while I'm there.
And you're going to be on the East Coast, you're going to be on the West Coast. Penguin sending you on a very nice little tour.
Yes, I am so fortunate. I mean, in this day and age, I know how difficult it is with shrinking publishing budgets. And marketing budgets, but I'm from New York, so I'll be doing a number of events in the three boroughs and in Hackensack, New Jersey, and then a couple of events in Boston, well, just this past event at the Muse Conference, and then LA, San Francisco, and Seattle. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Is there something that you're hoping that people are going to say to you that they got out of reading Read Jane?
I hope that I would, you know, they say with writing that it is through the specific details that you achieve the universal. And just from the onset, you would think, oh, this is a Korean-American retelling of Jane Eyre set in New York City and Seoul. If I'm not either Korean-American or I'm not a female or I'm not from New York, how can I connect to this book? I have actually been surprised just with early copies that have gone out there in the world to be getting positive feedback from middle-aged white men from the middle of the country, you know, various booksellers, and for me, that was so touching, and I hope that that's something that that this book, that Read Jane, can achieve, that it can speak to anyone who's just had that feeling of isolation, feeling, you know, that they're supposed to fit in, but they don't quite belong, and that I would hope that they could find us, you know, a small comfort in the pages. That would be my big dream and my big hope.
I think that's really terrific. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Patricia.
Oh, thank you, Cindy. It was such a pleasure.
I was delighted to speak with Aline Ohanessian about Orhan's Inheritance. It's a beautiful novel I'd heard so much about before even knowing who Aline was. As I mentioned earlier, it's a story that begins in a small village in Turkey with the death of Orhan's grandfather, the patriarch of the family, who has bequeathed the family home to a woman that no one has ever heard of. To find this woman, Orhan travels across the world and discovers her living in a home for elderly Armenians. Their meeting leads to a long, buried account of two people deeply in love, torn apart by war and terrible sacrifice.
Orhan's Inheritance is my first novel. It is about a young Turkish man who, at the death of his grandfather, discovers that his family and his country and his own identity is shrouded in mystery and secrecy. And his grandfather has left the family home where his father and aunt still live, to a perfect stranger in Los Angeles, a woman who's living in an old folks' home or a nursing home in Los Angeles. And he goes to discover who she is and why his beloved grandfather has left everything to her. And so it's really about him discovering a lot about himself and his family and ultimately his country's history. But it also takes place in the waning years of the Ottoman Empire, 1915, and it has a beautiful love story at the center of that. That narrative, the 1915 narrative, the backdrop of that is the Armenian Genocide. And the two main characters are his grandfather, Kemal, at age 19, and a very young Armenian Christian girl.
So I'm interested in learning about where this novel came from. I know that you have a master's degree in history, but you have been writing for quite a while.
I have. This novel actually came from my own family experience. So all of my grandparents are genocide survivors. And I first heard about this horrific historical event from my great-grandmother, Elizabeth, who told me about her escape, her survival from the death marches. And I was very, very young when she told me that story, and it just stayed with me and really haunted me. And when I sat down to write a novel, it's really no big surprise that that would, you know, that incident or that historical event became the center of this world that I was building.
So when did you decide to start writing it? Is it something you've been doing for many years, or did you establish yourself as a short story writer first?
I didn't. Actually, I've always been writing, but it's always been long form. For some reason, I love reading novels, so I think writers write things that they like to read. And I do read a lot of short stories, but my favorite pastime is being lost in a novel, and the thicker and bigger, the better. So I set out to write the kind of novel that I love to read. And I loved Middlesex. I loved, A Known World by Edward P. Jones. These were, very literary novels, but, were also historical and taught me about a time and place I wanted to know more about. And I knew a lot about, Ottoman history, and especially the last 10 or 15 years. So I set out to write about what I knew, but of course I had to do an extensive research. I studied a lot of primary sources and diaries, and read a lot of history books, and lost myself in the research. It was like falling down a rabbit hole.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
So I heard about your book actually on Twitter before it was published, through New England resident and just author extraordinaire Chris Bojalian, who I know has written quite a bit about the Armenian people and the genocide. Has he been a mentor to you, or do you have some relationship with him?
I've met him, and he was extremely gracious when my book was only a manuscript, and he offered to blurb it once I got an agent, and he definitely made good on that very generous promise and gave me a blurb. He isn't a mentor because I've only met him, I think, twice now, but it's been really wonderful to see what he did with that particular novel, The Sandcastle Girls, because he made a lot of people aware of this particular historical event that, we're unfamiliar with it.
So is educating people about the genocide and this part of life that undoubtedly the majority of Americans don't know anything about, was that part of your purpose for writing this book?
No, not at all. I set out to write the best novel I could write. And for me, that means the first number one thing a novel has to do is entertain the reader. I think the history lesson is a nice byproduct. And if you do your job well as a novelist, you learn from every novel you read, even if it's about somebody's, interior life, someone suffering a nervous breakdown. So I think all novels have the ability, all good novels have the ability to create transformation in the reader. It just, and hopefully the best novels create transformation on many levels. You may sort of, a good novel may change the way you think about love or memory. If I could do that, and also tell people about something they didn't know about in history, then that's wonderful. But it wasn't my number one goal. I didn't set out to educate the world about this particular historical event. I set out to write the best novel I could possibly write and move the reader, make them feel things and think of things and expand the way they see certain things. The history lesson is a wonderful aspect of this novel, and it was intentional, but it wasn't my primary concern.
So you talk about how reading a novel can be transformational, and that is absolutely true in so many different ways. Is it fair to say that writing a novel can be transformational as well?
Oh, absolutely. For someone like me, who's an Armenian-American writer who's part of the diaspora community, I'm bilingual, to write from the perspective of several Turkish men. It was just extremely enlightening, and I learned a lot from these characters, all of these characters, not just the Turkish ones. I'm definitely changed in many, many ways for having written this novel.
So the book tour for Orhan's Inheritance is going to take you across the country, including to New England. You're going to be in Boston in May, and actually all of your dates are available on your website.
Yes.
Are you looking forward to the opportunity to talk with people from so many different places and who bring so many of their own histories and stories to the reading of yours?
Yes, I am not one of these shy, introverted writers. I really enjoy people. I am introverted, and I do spend a lot of time alone, but I really enjoy interacting with readers. I'm getting probably one or two letters a day, emails that are lengthy, sort of emotional responses to the book, and I love the variety in my readership. I love hearing from different people all around the country with very different backgrounds responding to this novel. I'm really looking forward to the tour.
That's absolutely fabulous. And is there hope? Are you hoping that people say something to you? You know, is there anything that besides "I like your book"? Is there something that you're hoping that people get out of it?
You know, I poured 6 years of my life, like everything I fear and love and know and question, into this novel. So my favorite interactions are conversations and discussions when people not only tell me how they responded to the book, but the ideas, that the themes that are in it. I love discussing that with readers. So I like the inquiry more than, you know, I don't want to hear a specific thing. I just love the discussion that comes from a close reading of any novel. And so I'm really looking forward to that.
And Aline, I know you're an alum of the Breadloaf Writers Conference here in New England. Did any part of this book come from that experience?
No, in fact, I went to Squaw Valley when I was writing this novel. I went to Breadloaf when the novel had already been sold and had already, the copy edits even had been finalized. And I went to Breadloaf with the first two or three chapters of my second novel.
Oh, how exciting. So is that done?
No, I am working on it. It's hard to write when you're on tour, I've discovered.
Yes.
But I look forward to getting back to it. It's always sort of percolating in my mind, which is funny. I feel like I have one foot in the Ottoman Empire in 1915 and one foot in 19th century California, and somehow still existing in, you know, 21st century USA. So, it's been an interesting sort of, it's sort of like cooking five meals at once, if I could compare it to anything. Like lots of different pots and things and different recipes all percolating at the same time.
You better have a notebook with lists, and I imagine, right? You must carry around something that you can jot down ideas.
Yeah, I have. I have a whole system that is extremely helpful. Yeah, I've got different colored notebooks for the different pieces or projects I'm working on.
I love it. I'm glad you mentioned what your system was, because I was going to ask you, because it's so interesting. Every writer has their own way of doing things, you know, and it's what works for them. It's where the thoughts they organize. It's where the thoughts grow. And we do have thoughts in the strangest places.
We really do. And I wish I could say I would, I knew how to utilize Scrivener or something high tech like that, but I have a giant cork board behind me in my home office, and I use these 5x7 index cards. It's very archaic, but just the feel of the paper and something about using the longhand, the pen on scratching away at notebooks, that for some reason fuels my creativity. I do hop on a laptop once I've got a good couple pages of the voice and I have an idea. Once I'm rooted into the scene and the voice of a character, then I could switch to a notebook. But everything begins with paper and pens.
A lot of people say that. And chaos. The most beautiful things, though, come out of chaos.
Well, I hope so.
When you're out and about and people say, oh, you wrote a novel, what's it about? What's your pitch? What's your, you know, elevator speech for why someone should consider your novel?
I wish I had a better pitch. I think being alone for 6 years in a room by myself doesn't help me there. But what I say usually is it's about a young Turkish man who goes to bury his grandfather and realizes that he doesn't know as everything about his grandfather or himself or his family or his country. And he is forced to travel to Los Angeles to try to discover why his grandfather left the family home to a stranger. And that the book has two plots. It's half of it takes place in 1990 Los Angeles, and the second half takes place in the Ottoman Empire in 1915 in a small village. That is my pitch. You know, it's not great because I'm not great at, you know, selling anything. I think it's a very complex novel. You know, it's got two whole different plots and two sets of characters. It's difficult to condense all of that in a, you know, three or four sentences. But I try every time.
Absolutely. Well, you can definitely hear in your voice the care and the passion that you have for this book and the story that you've written.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Aline will be in New England for three events next week. The morning of Wednesday, May 13th, she'll be at Bank Square Books in Mystic, Connecticut. The evening of Wednesday, May 13th, she'll be at RJ Julia in Madison, Connecticut. And on Thursday, May 14th, she'll be at Porter Square Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Aline has a wonderful website where you can go to learn more. And I have copies of Orhan's Inheritance that you can win by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. There's still time to tweet or email us to win all of the titles we featured tonight. We'll take entries until noontime Friday, May 8th. I also want to wish happy book birthdays to historical novelists Erica Roebuck and Sarah McCoy. Erica's novel is The House of Hawthorns, and Sarah's is The Map Maker's Children. Both books go on sale Tuesday, May 5th, and I had the pleasure of hosting a Twitter chat with Erica and Sarah last week, where the tweets came fast and furiously, books were given away, and it was just a fantastic time. So congrats, ladies, on your books coming out, as well as to Patricia Park, since Ree Jane's birthday is May 5th, too. I'm going to sign off now thanking Patricia, Aline, and Kirsten for talking with me and being the guests on our show this week. Thanks also to you for listening. I hope you'll be back next week as we bring you another episode of the Literary New England Radio Show. In between, we have all kinds of listings and information and fascinating articles that you can find on our blog, which is located at www.LitNewEngland.com. If you ever have any ideas for guests, I hope you'll send them to us. We love to get your comments, and I'm always interested in your story ideas. Until we come again next week, have a great week and great reading.